Okay, gentlemen, after wishing everyone a Shavuot Tov, we're on Daf Chaf Hei Amud Beis. And we were discussing the case of Mafriche Yonim. And we were trying to figure out what Mafriche Yonim are all about. They're listed here in the Mishnah Chaf Hei Amud Aleph as one of the categories of Psulei Edus. They are disqualified for testimony. And the Gemara offered two explanations. The first explanation is anonymous. It's not attached to any particular name. And that is, these are pigeon racers. So they bet on a pigeon. It's their favorite pigeon. They've trained this pigeon to race as fast as possibly it can. And they put down a bet on the pigeon. That's the first anonymous opinion. It's not attached to any particular amora. The second opinion is that of Rabbi Chama. And he says that this pigeon has been trained to attract other pigeons from other coops that come from far and wide. And the owner of this pigeon, who's trained this pigeon, is now ready to net and steal, so to speak, all these pigeons. Now we're going to discuss later exactly whether that's considered theft or not considered theft. In any event, the Gemara now on Daf Chaf Hei Amud Beis is quoting a long brisa, the subject of which is Chazara. Chazara means, if you have someone who is disqualified as a witness, how does he reinstate himself? He has to do what?
Tshuva.
And the question is, what level of tshuva does he have to do? And the underlying principle is that he has to go to the other extreme. It's not just enough that he declares, I'm doing tshuva, and maybe he changes his clothes, he's unkempt, or anything like that. He has to do something much more profound. So the brisa goes through four categories, all of which are mentioned in the Mishnah, of psulei edus, those who are disqualified, and how they do tshuva. So before we start the Gemara for today, let me just review some of the highlights of what we did on Thursday. So if anybody wasn't here on Thursday, they'll be able to clue in today. Bob, that's good for you, yeah? So you weren't here on Thursday because this is your first time. So we wish Bob a lot of hatzlacha. You'll decide if you can come once a week, more than once a week, whatever you can come, that's good for us.
Came to the right place,
okay.
So the right teacher.
Okay.
Okay. So here's what's going on, Bob. There are four categories mentioned in the mission of people who are doing the wrong thing. They're misbehaving, and as a result, we disqualify them for testimony. It means, for the love of money, they're willing to violate the Torah law, and such a person is suspect of perhaps perjuring himself in a court of law. He'll be paid off to give false testimony. So don't trust him unless he does a full-fledged tshuva. The first category is called Mesachek Bekuvia. You don't have to write this down, don't worry. But Mesachek Bekuvia means a gambler. And there are different levels of gambling. There's one real professional gambler. He actually buys chips. And he bets with these chips. And those are called fisfasin. Again, you don't have to write down the word fisfasin. You won't encounter this word too many times for the rest of your life. So I'm not expecting you to memorize the word fisfasin. But these fisfasin, for the most sophisticated, professional, dedicated gamblers, are pieces of wood that apparently are shaped in a certain way, and they are dedicated, just like today, thousands of years after this, where we have chips. You go into a casino and you get chips, and the first thing on the agenda of this high level Mesachek Bekuvia is to get rid of these chips. He has to simply throw them in the rubbish bin. He has to indicate that he's completely cut off from gambling. Then the Gemara in the Brisa quotes a lower level gambler. He's not such a highfalutin gambler. He doesn't buy these chips, but they used to use like sort of makeshift or substitute chips. What they did is they took the shells of very strong shells of certain produce. Let's say, for example, if you've ever dried outside peel of a walnut, right? A walnut has a very heavy and thick chip. Or, for example, a pomegranate, if you dry the klipa, the outside covering of a pomegranate. So these are cheap kinds of things, but nevertheless, if he has them laying around, he's got to get rid of them. Not only that, it's not enough that he breaks these chips or these different instruments that he uses for gambling. He has to completely desist from gambling, even not to play these games b'chinam. The same games that you play for money, you could play for entertainment. But he has to go to the other extreme. Even though playing these games for entertainment, you know, like playing Monopoly and so forth, that would not be something that would again be against the Torah. But nevertheless, he has to go to the other extreme to completely cut himself off from gambling. Now we have the second category. These are people who borrow or lend money with usury, with interest. And what is their chazara? How do they do tshuva in order to reinstate them as kosher edim? Number one, they have to rip up any documents that they may have prepared for this kind of a loan. Number two, they have to absolutely desist from any kind of loan whatsoever with ribbis, even to lend money to a non-Jew. Technically, you're allowed to lend money to a non-Jew if he agrees to pay interest, and you can take that interest. But in the context of chazara, of an absolute tshuva, to make sure that he's completely cut off from loaning money, lending money, beribis, he shouldn't even accept ribbis from a non-Jew. Then we have the third case, which is the case that's going to occupy our minds today, and that's Mafriche Yonim. And the Bryce identifies Mafriche Yonim in a way that we can figure out what they are. And that's going to be the Shakla Vitari of the Gemara. Because Mafriche Yonim are called in the Brisa those that fight one another. They get very angry. And it seems like they're in a kind of a contest for which of these birds. You can imagine, let's say, a hawk fight or an eagle fight. You know, you've trained your eagle against his eagle and you bet money on it. And the Gemara says he could even do this with behemos, chayos, and ophos. You know, any animal whatsoever, whatever species is, you can train him in such a way that you put him in the Colosseum, you put him in the rink, and he plays he fights a battle. You know, it's a wrestling match to see which animal could defeat which animal. And you've trained the animal, you bet on the animal, you're taking money for this. This is another form of gambling. So how do you do tshuva? Number one, they used to get the animal all worked up and angry and fight this battle, they used to use certain kinds of pieces of wood that they would bang together, and the clop, the sound that came out of it, would get the animals all riled up. So he has to get rid of those. And then he has to again desist from any kind of these animal contests, even if he's playing for free. Even if these animals are out in the wild and they don't belong to anyone, he's not stealing anything from anyone, nevertheless, he has to go to the other extreme. And finally, the fourth category is Sochrei Shvius. Those are the ones who, during the seventh year, the Shemitah year, when they're not allowed to sell and market their fruits, they sell and market their fruits. How do they do tshuva? They have to go through another Shvius cycle. We have to wait another full 7 years. V'ibadu, and they demonstrate that they aren't selling any of the Peros Shvius. And then they have to go even beyond that. And that means they have to repay, and they have to give back all the money that they took when they sold the Shvius. And that's the fourth category of the four categories of those who are excluded from testimony because of their misbehavior and how they do tshuva to reinstate themselves. So now we're ready for the Gemara for today. All that was a review of what we did last week. We are now going to find the place on Chaf Hei Amud Beis. And we're up to Ketani Mihas. So let's see if we can somehow find Ketani Mias. If anybody has an easy way of finding it, you may see it. Tosfos on the right side of the page that starts with the word Stam. Anybody see that Tosfos? Chafei Abibay Stam. So if you go forward, meaning not forward, but backwards, I guess we'd say, go higher up on the page. Let's count 1, 2, 3 lines up. The first word in the line is La'aniyu. And then the second word, which is going to start our Gemara for today, is Ketani. Now this word Ketani is a conjugated verb of the noun Tanan. And Tanan is a word that can refer either to a Mishnah or to a Braisa. So Ketani means it was written in a Braisa. And the word Mihas means however. However, meaning even after we understood all the four categories of Chazara in all those four Psuliedus, nevertheless, what we want to understand is one particular line in the Braisa that seems to stick out like a sore thumb. And that is in the case of Mafriche Yonim, which is the third of the fourth category, four categories, it says, not only is it a Yonah, not only is it this pigeon, but it's also Behemah. It's also an animal. So the Gemara says the very fact that Mafriche Yonim doesn't have to be a Yonah, but it could be a Behemah. And the Bryce indicates that you could substitute a Behemah for Yonah and still be disqualified for testimony. That's going to give us an insight into what Mafriche Yonim is all about. We had two interpretations of Mafriche Yonim. Bishlam, I can understand it, Lamandi Omer, according to that one opinion. That was the anonymous opinion that we had first. Itakdeme Yonach Leon, if your Yonah, your pigeon, will get to the finish line before mine, then I'll pay you so much and so much money. Notice he's basically, instead of horse racing, he's betting not on horses, but he's betting on pigeons. Is Hainu Mishkachasle, therefore I can find the same thing, Bibehema, even an animal. Notice to the same extent that you could train a pigeon to race quickly to the finish line, and if you'll bet on him, so too you can train any animal to race fast. We have today we know of what dog races, what other animals do they race? I think. Horse racing, excellent horses. I mean, again, I don't know about cows. You know, it'd be interesting to see a cow race, you know, especially a pregnant cow. But whatever it is, you can theoretically train any animal. And it makes sense that any animal could substitute for Yonah, for a pigeon, as far as betting on a race is concerned. El Amad Yomar. But let's go according to the second opinion. That was Rabbi Chama, if you remember. His opinion was Ara. Ara means that you've trained this pigeon to attract other pigeons. So it flies up and it has a love call, you know, to the female, to the females, whatever it is, or the male to the females, and it is able to attract all these pigeons to come forward and land on a certain roof where the owner of the pigeon that was trained is ready and prepared in ambush with his nets. Is Behema Bas Hachihi? Can you really train an animal in such a way that it will attract other animals as like a decoy to get them to come and follow that animal? The Gemara assumes, again you could Google this and see what Dr. Google says about this, that there's no way you can train an animal. Pigeons are very, very unique, but animals simply cannot be trained to attract other animals. And therefore, this Braisa, which identifies Mafriche Yonim as any animal, not just a Yonah, would certainly clearly prove the first Shita, that anonymous Shita, that we're talking about races of some sort. And you could train any animal for a race. But if you hold like Rabbi Chama, that these Mafriche Yonim have trained pigeons to attract other pigeons, to fly with them together and land on a roof, that's not something that you can do with other animals. So Gemara says, in, yes, there is one kind of an animal which, although it's not a bird, it's not a pigeon, but yet it can be trained to attract other animals. And that's called Shar Habar. Now, the Masifta here doesn't translate Shar Habar. If you have an English translation, I'll tell you what I think Shar Habar is. You'll tell me if your translation reflects the same idea. This is a wild ox out in the wild. You'll find it in the wilderness. It's a special kind of an ox. And this ox is an ox that you normally, as you say, it's very hard to train this ox and domesticate it. And out in the wild, none of the other animals, you know, are interested in this ox. But you can train this ox in your home, you know, in your backyard, in such a way that it will go out to the deserts and it will be able to allure other animals to come into your corral, so to speak, where you'll be able to take them and steal them. Now, when I say steal, we'll get it back to that in just a second. First, I just want to know, what do you have in your English translation for Shor HaBor?
Wild ox.
Oh, wild ox. Okay, so I wasn't very far off. A wild ox. Okay. So again, we have to Google this. If you have time, please tell me what the wild ox looks like and where to find one, because I certainly want to train these oxen. These are very good oxen. They will absolutely allure other oxen. However, if I mean to take those other oxen that live within a domesticated urban area, that's stealing. Is that stealing? So the truth is that it's not exactly stealing. Why isn't it stealing? If you take a look at the Gemara that we learned earlier, we're going to see this again and again, there's something called Gezel Mishum Darkei Shalom. I should really write this on the board. It means it's a special category of theft that doesn't apply on a Doraisa level. On a Torah level, it doesn't technically constitute theft. But the Rabbanon, because they wanted to maintain the peace and harmony and protect society against any fights, any kind of anarchy and altercations, what they did was they instituted a prohibition against taking these, in this case, animals, because they wanted to guarantee Darkei Shalom. So now, we have animals that are technically not owned by anyone. What does that mean? According to the Torah law, in order to possess an animal, you would have to make a kinyan. You'd have to make a full-fledged act of acquisition. But we're talking about animals that basically come in from the outer wilderness. They enter into certain corrals. In Hebrew, they're called bibar. Bibar is a migrash mukaf gader. It's kind of a field or a corral that is surrounded by some sort of a fence. And they take wild animals from the wilderness and they actually allure them into these bibarim, and they grow them and they give birth and so forth and so on. So these are chayos shebe bibar, and they go in and out of the corral. Sometimes they come back to a corral because they're familiar with certain animals that inhabit that corral. But since they go in and out, they never really settle down. And therefore the owner of this bibar does not technically, according to the Torah law, acquire ownership over these chayos, over these animals. However, Chachamim made an institution, an enactment, just like in the case of pigeons that fly in from one coop to the other. That's that doesn't constitute technically gezel, theft doraisa. So too in these cases of the bibarim, of these various corrals that are fenced around, when the chayos come in and they grow there, they do so on their own initiative, and the owner of the corral never actually made a formal kinyan to acquire ownership of it. But Chazal said that since these animals are, for the temporary period of time, are going back and forth inside, let's say, Reuven's corral, therefore Shimon is not allowed to attract these animals into his corral. Now the only problem is that in order to fit this interpretation into the Braisa, when the Braisa discusses Mafriche Yonim and the substitutes thereof, it mentions Behema. Well, is a Shor HaBor considered a Behema? Now you and I may think, what difference it make? You know, it's very banal or insignificant to classify it as a Behema. But the truth is, there are two major differences between a behema and a chaya. Number one, the Torah says in Vayikra, Perek Zayin, Kol Ochel Chelev Min HaBehema is V'nichrasa Nefesh HaOcheles Me'ameha, that anyone who eats Chelev of a Behema has violated an Isur Kares. Now that's not true for a Chaya or an Oaf. Chelev only applies to the Chelev of a Behema.
It's a kosher animal.
It's a kosher animal, but obviously the Chelev...
Din.
Chelev is a very strict din. In fact, whenever Chazal want to give you an example of eating something that's kares, they usually give you the example of chelev.
Oh, okay.
So that's the first difference that you want to make a note of between a behema and a chayav yof. A behema is the only species of animals that has an isur chelev, but in chayav yof there's no isur chelev. Number two, and here we go the reverse way. In the cases of Chayav Yof after Shechita, the Torah requires Kisui Hadam. You have to cover over with some of the dirt on the ground the blood. And that's also in Vayikra Zion, and it says, Ve'ish ish mi b'nei Yisrael nager b'gar b'socham asher yatsud tzayid chaya o of asher ye ochel to kosher chaya kosher of Vishafaches domo, meaning shchita, after you do the shchita and the blood comes out, v'kiso b'ofar, and you have to cover it with ofar. That only applies to chayav yof. There's no mitzvah of kisi adam with regard to behema. So it's very important that we figure out whether or not a particular species belongs to either the category of behema or the category of chaya. There are some borderline cases which are a little bit ambiguous, and it's not clear whether it's a chaya or a behema. One of them is called a shor ha'bar.
Isn't a behema a domestic animal versus a chaya, which is a wild animal?
Could be. But this shor ha'bar is very strange, because on the one hand, it's out there in the wilderness. It's like very much like a chaya. It's not your classic ox, but nevertheless, it can be domesticated. So if you work very hard, you can domesticate this shor ha'bar. So what is the status of the shor ha'bar?
Similar to a koi?
No, a koi is going to be a combination of a behema and a chayav yof. So in the case of a koi, the chelev will be osur, and you chayav a kisi adam. In the case of shor ha'bar, it's either or. Either it's a behema, and you have an isur chelev without kisi adam, or it's a chaya, and you have kisi adam without chelev.
Why is the of coupled with the chaya as opposed to with the behema? Because if a person can't afford a behemoth, he can bring an oaf. So you would think that they are... That is true, but...
With regard to the shechita of an oaf, the Torah requires kisi adam. Perhaps because an oaf is such a common kind of a shechita, and the blood is, you know, I don't know, have you ever seen shechita of an oaf? You know, the blood splatters. If you ever go for, you know, for kaparis... sometimes if you ask the person who does the shechita to allow you to do the kisi adam, because after all you paid for the kaparas, he'll allow you to do so. So the Torah requires kisi adam in the case of oaf. You know, if we wanted to study these laws in a philosophical vein, we would probably be best to study Rav Shimshon Lefol Hirsch. I can't promise you as an answer to your question, but that's where I would look. That would be my first address. He wrote a 2-volume work in German, which has been translated into English, called Chorev. And a lot of the first volume is dedicated to the kashrus laws, to try to explain which animals the Torah classifies as kosher, non-kosher, which require this, which require that. So that really belongs to the philosophical realm. You may find something in the Rambam, in Mor Nevuchim. I don't know. I tend to doubt it, but it's possible. But this is, you know, Rav Shimshon Lefol Hirsch put this as an agenda on his agenda. So what do we have now? We have this case of a shor ha'bar. Is it a behema or is it not? So the Gemara says, Kemandi Omar, that this explanation, in order to defend and reconcile the Braisa with Rabbi Chama, would reflect the Shita, Kemandi Omar, the one who holds shor ha'bar min behemahu. And this is going to be a Mishnah in Masechta Kelayim in the 8th Perek. That's going to record a controversy among the Tanoim, between the Tanakam and Rabbi Yossi. What is the status of a shor ha'bar? Is it a behemah which would mean the chalev is an isekares, which would mean that there's no chiyuv of kisi adam, or is it a chaya, which would mean there's no iser chalev, but there is a mitzvah of kisi adam. Now the reason why the Mishnah in Kilayim is the best place to find an answer to your question, how do you categorize a certain species, is because the Torah prohibits what's called harbas kilayim. Harbas kilayim means to crossbreed two different species. So you're allowed to breed two behemos, and you're allowed to breed two chayos, but you're not allowed to breed a chayo with a behema. So it's very important to know whether a particular species belongs to behema or belongs to chaya. This now we learned in the Mishnah, shar habar min behemahu, which means that a shar habar, this wild ox that will be found in the, that inhabits the wilderness, will have an iser chelev, but no mitzvah of kisi adam. Why? Because it's behema. Rabbi Yossi disagrees. He says fundamentally it's out there in the wilderness, it's a minchaya, belongs to the chayos that live out in the wild, and therefore the chelev of a shar habar is mutter, but you'd have to do kisi adam after the shechita, like any chaya and like any oaf. So the Chachamim hold that a shar habar, since since naturally, even though it grows in the midbar, but now you can domesticate it, therefore it's classified as a behema. Now it's interesting, I have a comment here from the Bar Tanura. You know, the Bar Tanura is the super commentary on Mishnayos. And in Masechet Kelayim, on that Mishnah that we just studied, he makes the following comment, which is a little bit different. It's a bit of a curveball. He says, Chachamim Sovrim, Sheshar Habar, Shegodel Achshav Bamidbar, Ikro Me'ayishuv. This is not the way we understood it. He says that according to Chachamim, the Shar Habar actually, historically, you know, during its evolution period, began its career as a separate category of a shar in the yishuv. But what did it do? It was attracted to go out to the midbar, and it became more or less an inhabitant of the wilderness. But in its original creation, it was a shar like any other shar. Now, what would have attracted this particular shar to go out into the midbar, and then over the course of history to develop its own, you know, genetic structure as a shar? I don't know. But somehow it was allured out to the midbar, and it got so used to living out in the midbar, that's where it decided to settle. But its original formulation, the way God created it, was that of a yishuv, that of a behema like any other ox. Rabbi Yossi holds that no, you're misunderstanding what's the nature of this shar habar. It never began in the yishuv. It was never in the yishuv. It was ikro bamidbar. It was out in the midbar. And therefore it has a din, like any animal that lives in the midbar, it's a chaya. The fact that you were able to lure this ox into your yishuv and domesticate it, that doesn't change its inherent status. Our Gemara here is interested only in the Chachamim Shita. We're not in the least bit interested in Rabbi Yossi. We're only quoting Rabbi Yossi here because we quoted the Mishnah in its complete form. Our Shita, in our Braisa, reflects the Chachamim. And that is that Shar HaBar is a min behema. And since the Shar HaBar could now allure other animals, therefore, like the Yonah, it has this gambling kind of propensity where people would gamble on the Shar HaBar to see if they could steal animals from other people's corrals. Again, as I repeat for the third time, it would not be gezel d'oraisa because no one has actually made a kinyan, a formal acquisition on any of these animals that were lured. But nevertheless, the Chachamim enacted on Iser gezel, which is only d'rabbanon, mipnei darkei shalom.
Is there also a napkin that means to be Zeta trapping from Midvarim?
What's a Zeta? I don't even know what it is.
Trapping.
It's Zeta with its Italian. Zeta.
That if it's found in the Midvarim, on Yom Tov.
Oh, you're talking about B'shais and Beitza, right.
Right.
Okay.
Does it have an opportunity there, if it's a Chaya or Behema? If it's a Behema...
Right, you're talking about Mukta, I think. Am I right?
That it's not viewed as if it was trapped on it came there by its own volition.
Right, I'd have to see the Mishnah in Beitza to remind myself, but if I'm not mistaken, the discussion there is not about the Malach of Tzedek, I'm just talking to myself now,
right.
But rather about Mukta.
Okay.
Whether it's Mukta. In other words, let's say under certain circumstances, in Malechus Ochel Nefesh on Yom Tov, you would be allowed to capture an animal for the purpose of shechting it.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if everybody would agree with that statement, but maybe there is such a sheet. Yerushalmi says that Malechus Ochel Nefesh is only me, Lisha Vielach. But let's say, if we hold that any Malacha of the 39 Malachas theoretically could become Ochel Nefesh, if you do that Malacha for the purpose of Ochel Nefesh, Tzedah could theoretically come under Ochel Nefesh. But there's another problem with Tzedah on Yom Tov, and that's what we call Muktzah. And it's interesting, the Gemara tells us in Beitza that Chachamim, the Chazal, were more makpid on Muktzah on Yom Tov than they are on Shabbos. Whole sugi over there, Basil Zizulime, at the beginning of Masechta Beitza. So you have certain animals where there's no tzedah. I mean, this is the whole issue of owning a dog and so forth and so on. Are you considered trapping the dog when you hold it with the leash on Shabbos or Yom Tov? So if it's a what's called mizonoseichem aleichem, meaning that you've taken upon yourself that you have to feed that animal, then that's not considered tzedah and it's not considered muktzah. So Reuven is pointing out that what would be the status of a shor bar? So I'm gonna put myself out on a limb here, and I'm gonna take a guess at this. I'm gonna say that according to everyone, even according to Rabbi Yossi, who holds that a shor bar originally was a midbar inhabitant, that it's really a chaya, but nevertheless, once you've trained it, you remove the isur mukta. It would be locally domesticated, and you have access to it, and if there's no Issa Tzeda on Yom Tov, because it's Malechus Ochel Nefesh, there would be no Issa Muktzah, even according to Rabbi Yossi.
If it came from the Midbar.
No, I'm saying if once you domesticate. Again, if you go out into the Midbar, in order to find the Shor HaBar, because you want to shecht it and eat its meat.
Your Berarim,
the Beririm that we spoke about? Right, the Beririm has the same status as domesticated.
Oh, that's excellent.
Okay, now we start a little bit of a different angle or dimension of the sugya of psule edus. The Braisa that we mentioned earlier tells us that there are certain categories of thieves, of gazlanim, who are disqualified midirabbanan. Tana, we learned in the Braisa, hosifu aleihem, which means the Bryce is adding new categories to what we found in our mission. In our mission, we had four categories of disqualified witnesses. Now we're adding another two categories. And Hosifu Aleha means they, the Chachamim, enacted an additional two categories of disqualifications for witnesses. What are those two categories? Hagazlanim veHachamsonim. Now, gazlanim are people who they put their hands into your pocket and they steal from you. Chamsonim are those who, and again, we have to get into all the details as we go along, they force you to sell something. So technically, they haven't stolen anything from you. They pay you a full price, but you had no interest in selling the object. They coerce you into selling it. So let's take this price as a given, and then in a very picayune way, one at a time, try to analyze each of these two categories. The first category is a gazlan. So the Gemara asks the following obvious question. Gazlan, are you telling me that Hosif Aleim, that the Rabbanon added a new category to disqualify a gazlan? The Oraisa who, and I would add a word nifsal, meaning he's possible on a Doraisa level. The Torah says, Al Tashes Yodcha im Rasha Lios Eid Hamas. A Rasha is anyone who violates the Torah law, including Gzela. Now here we have a gigantic machlokes between the Rashi and the Rambam, which I discussed and will continue to discuss with Hashem in the Iyun Shiurim. I'm just going to mention it in passing. It requires a great deal of study. The Rambam says that it's not true that every single violation of a Torah law makes you into a Rasha as far as Eidus is concerned. It's only a violation of a lav, of a violation of the Torah law that generates malchus. Because we have many lavim, many violations of lotuses, which do not generate malchus. We have what's called, again, I'm not going to go into this now, there's something called a lav anita in lasharis misus bezdin, there's something called a lav anita litashlumin, there's a lav anita kliese. There are many, many categories, and for this you have to learn a mesecta called makas, to figure out which lavim belong to groups of lavim that don't generate malchus. And the Rambam says those groups do not, the violators of those groups will not be disqualified for testimony, at least on a Doraisa level. Because when the Torah says that you're a Rasha, it means a Rasha who gets malchus. The Torah always identifies a Rasha as someone who will get 39 lashes. Therefore, the Rambam comes to the conclusion that a gazlan, as despicable as he is, he should not be considered posel yedus, l'chora, at least at first glance. Why? Because how many malchus do you get for theft?
Zero.
Why don't you get malchus for theft, Steve? Do you remember?
Well, you can...
Essay means that the Torah requires you to return the stolen object. That's called Veheshiv Asagzela Asher Gozal. In the case of a lav anitak le'essay, you don't get malchus. So here we have a famous chiddush from Rav Yonah and Eibishitz, and he claims that even the Rambam would agree that a gazlan has to be posel d'oraisa based on this Gemara that we're reading now. And the reason for it is that you don't get malchus not because there's something lenient about this violation. It's a lower level violation. Like, for example, there's something called the lav shein bo maisa, where you didn't do an action, you don't get malchus. That's a lower level. Here, the Torah says that we're going to give you the option to fix up your avera by returning the lost object. In fact, if you don't... the stolen object. If, in fact, you don't return the stolen object, you will get malchus. And that's a sugya called bitlo velo bitlo, chemo velo chemo, and you do get malchus. So basically, the violation of gzela has malchus inherent in it. Technically, it could be you won't get malchus because we're going to give you the option of returning the stolen object. But in and of itself, the essence of gzela, lotigzel, is a lav like any other lav, and you become a rasha. So why does our braisa have to claim, hosifu aleim, that the Rabbanon disqualified a gazlan? Lo nitzcha, the Gemara says, the reason why the Chacham had to pasel a gazlan, elo lemitzias cheresh shote v'katon. There was a lost object. What's the status, Rabbosei, of a lost object? Who owns a lost object? There's no simon on it. It's out there in the middle. It's called what? Hefker. Now, anyone who comes and picks up the hefker, that's called kolakotim zocha, will now acquire ownership on this ownerless object. Except there's only one proviso. That person who acquires ownership has to be what's called a bar das. And a bar das is someone who does not fit into any of these three categories called a cheresh, a shota, and a katan. Now, cheresh might not be what you and I think a cheresh is. Cheresh sounds like what? A deaf person, but that's not what a cheresh is. A cheresh is a deaf mute who's not able to communicate. Today we have very sophisticated methods of teaching a cheresh how to communicate. But back in the day, the cheresh was unable to communicate. A shota, by the way, is not what you and I think it is. We're not talking about someone who's insane, but with someone who manifests very strange on a sociological level in terms of his relationship to society, strange behavior patterns.
Social.
What do you say?
Social path.
Social patterns, yeah.
Social path.
He's a social path. Yeah, he's not in the category of normal as far as his social skills are concerned. Very extreme, though. And he has to have four simonim, like one of which he would be willing to sleep in a cemetery. I mean, different kinds of behavior patterns. I mean, you'd have to be a psychiatrist to figure out exactly who would be classified as a shota. And a katan is any youngster, a minor, who's below the age of 12 in the case of a female, 13 in the case of a male. And now, one of these categories of people, the common denominator of which is the labar das, they don't have das, picks up this hefker. Now you want to come along and grab it out of the katan's hands. Well, on a doraisa level, you have not violated the isur gezel. Why is that not gezel on a doraisa level? Because since he's a labar das, he cannot acquire this object. However, the chachamim said you're not allowed to take it from him. And that was enacted as a divrei shalom, as a gezel mipnei darkei shalom. So that now, if a person steals from a katan or a cheresh, he is a gazlon on a drabbanon level. But again, keep in mind that it was at one moment in history that the chachamim made this decision. And there were two different moments in history. Moment number one was the moment that the Rabbanan instituted something called Gezel Midarkei Shalom, that you're not allowed to take it from the Cheresh Shalom to a Katan because it is considered theft because of Darkei Shalom to protect the peace. But even at that level, at that moment in time, the Chacham didn't go as far as to say that a person who steals from a Katan is Pasul Yedus. Meikara, originally, when the Rabbanon enacted this Darkei Shalom prohibition, Sover, they thought, we're not going to pasul such a gazlan. Mitzias Cheresh Shalom V'Katan, to steal an object that was found by one of these three categories, Lo Shchicha, which means it's not a common occurrence. You know, to go ahead and find a Katan who acquires ownership on an ownerless hefker mitzia and then grab it out of his hands, you know, that wasn't something that was common. Now we have a rule that milsa de lo shchicha, that which is not common, lo gazru be rabbanon, the rabbanon don't enact different kinds of laws and fences around something that is unusual. It remind me, I want to give you an example of that in a minute. But first I want to finish this Gemara. Inami, another explanation as to why originally the Chachamim were hesitant, they were inhibited to institute this category of a psul edus in the case of someone who grabs a lost object out of the hands of a cheresh or a shota of a katan, is mipnei darkei shalom v'alma. They only instituted darkei shalom. And they said, look, treat the cheresh shalt of a katan the way you would treat any mature individual who's intelligent, and don't take anything out of his hands. But they never called it gezel. That was historical period number one. But Kavan, in historical period number two, once they saw the chazu, they saw the sof, mamona hudika shakli, people are grabbing money out of the hands of the cheresh shalt of a katan, and it became like a hefkervelt, you know, people would grab it, and they were so in love with money that they would grab it out of the hands of a cheresh shalt of a katan, and they would completely ignore the takanas chachamim. They couldn't care less. It's then paslinu rabbanan. Rabbanan said we have to take harsh measures. If we want to give teeth to our enactment that you're not allowed to steal from a cheresh shalt of a katan, then we've got to pasul someone for edus. No one wants to be disqualified for testimony. That's an insult to his very status in society. He knows that people are judged by whether or not they can testify, and that's going to be a deterrent so that he would not very quickly put his hand into the pocket of a katan and steal the object. So just to go over the Gemara is saying that there is a case of gezel which would not constitute and qualify as gezel on a doraisa level, and those are the cases of cheresh, shoto, katan. However, the Rabbanan at some point in time decided that this will be considered gzela if you take from a cheresh shel to a katan. And what made them make that decision? Initially, they only established Dar Kishon that you shouldn't tamper and take something out of the hands of a cheresh shel to a katan. But later on, when they got to the point where it was intolerable, I mean, people just they were taking the law into their own hands. They were totally ignoring the enactments of the Chacham. They were grabbing things out of the hands of a katan, etc. So the Rabbanan said, you know what? We're going to hit you with the harsh law, and we're going to make you into a posel because of Gzela Derabbanan. Now, one question which is raised here by Tosis, Divya Maskel E, which is all the way on top of your page, is that it would seem that we've already learned this halacha in the Mishnah itself. What is the Braisa adding to us? The Mishnah already told us that Mafriche Yonim are posel Yedus. Now, in the case of Mafriche Yonim, if you remember, according to Rabbi Chama, Mafriche Yonim are not gamblers, but rather they are people who train the Yonah in order to attract other Yonim from other coops and steal them. But that's not Gzela, because they never really were owned by the owners of the other coops. It was only that the bird went into the coop, and then the Rabbanan instituted what's called Gzela Mishum Darkei Shalom. And such a person who draws the birds from other people's coops is in fact disqualified for testimony. So we already have a precedent in our Mishnah that a violator of Darkei Shalom, of Gezel Mipnei Darkei Shalom, is Pasul Yedus. So why did the Chacham feel that they had to add another category of Pasul Yedus in the case of a Mitzia of a Cheresh Shalom to a Katan? That should already be included under their initial enactment of Mafriche Yonim. So Tosis answers that this logic of the Gemara is being offered according to the Vadi Omer, who says Mafriche Yonim in our Mishnah is referring to bird racing. That they train the pigeon to race and they put money down, and that would qualify as a Doraisa, not as Darkei Shalom. So in effect, Tosis has sort of committed our Braisa that we're learning now to the position that Mafriche Yonim is not Ola, it's not that kind of a Yona that attracts other Yonim, because that would only be Darkei Shalom, and then we're not adding anything new in the case of Mitzias Cheshel to Katan. However, the Meiri wants to write that Mafriche Yonim in our Mishnah, Lo hayu yodim lifsol hagozel mitzias. If we only had the case of Mafriche Yonim, according to Rabbi Chama, that attract other birds from other coops, we would not be able to derive any conclusion as far as stealing from an object that was found by a cheresh shel to a katan. We would have made a distinction, says the Meiri, between two categories of Darkei Shalom. In the case of Mafriche Yonim, the Darkei Shalom is directly between the person who is trapping these birds that flew in from other coops and the owners of those coops. You know, we're trying to avoid a head-on collision, a head-on altercation. Why are you stealing the Yonim that went into my coop? And that's a serious violation of Darkei Shalom. However, in the case of Cheresh Shel to a Katan, the Darkei Shalom is not because of your relationship to the Katan, or the Cheresh or the Shotav, but rather to your relationship to the relatives. The relatives are going to be upset. They felt that, you know, their brother, who's a Cheresh or a Shotav or a Katan, picked up this lost object, and they have rights to acquire it. So the Rabbanan said, Darkei Shalom, you're not allowed to take it away. But maybe in such a case, since it's not an Eresh class, it's not a first class, heavy and intense, profound violation of Darkei Shalom, here maybe we would have thought that there's no psul edus, and therefore the Braisa had to add this category called a gezel mitnei Darkei Shalom in the cases of cheresh shel to
v'katan. So according to the first verse, the way he understands Mafriche Yonim, that's like gambling. How that there is yonim used for gambling? How is it different from a sacher b'kumi? Separating it.
Yeah. So the Gemara asks that question. That was when you were not here. Let me just quickly show you the Gemara. The Gemara says, let's go back to Daf Chaf Hei Amid Aleph. And the Gemara says the following. Uman di Omer, according to Rabbi Chama, so let's see if we can find this. This is for, five lines up before the end of Chaf Hei Amid Aleph. Rabbi Chama, who holds that Mafricha Yom is Ara, my taima. For what reason, Lo Amar, itetagmech yonech liyonin, that this was a race? Omalachos, Rabbi Chama answers, Hainu mesachik bekubia, because then Mafricha Yonim is simply a repeat performance of mesachik bekubia. Why would the Tana feel compelled? Why would it be necessary for him to repeat himself? The Idoch, as the Gemara says, why? Why, according to that man, the Yomer, who identifies Mafricha Yonim as betting on the Yonah, which is another form of gambling, why did the Mishnah have to add it? And the Gemara answers, Tana Tola Vidas Atzmo, V'Tana Tola Vidas Yono. That the difference is that in the case of a gambler, he relies on his own professional skills, again, professional in inverted commas. I don't know exactly how professional the poker players are, but in any event, they rely on the fact that they'll be able to beat their adversary, their contestant. However, in the case of a Yonah, it really totally depends on the mood of the Yonah. In other words, as much as you train the Yonah, you don't know if you'll be successful if the Yonah's not in the mood to fly as fast as you want. So therefore, and that's a whole difference about Asmachta, which we're not gonna repeat now. So where are we up to now? Cham Sonim. You remember that the Brice had two categories of misbehaviors, which the Rabbanan added to the list of disqualified Eidus. And the second category was Chamsonim. Now, why is it that a Chamson who actually pays the money is possibly Eidus? Why is it that initially the Chachamim would let it go and they would allow a Chamson to testify, and then they changed their mind and at some point in history they enacted a psul and established that a Chamson is disqualified for Eidus? The Gemara says, Meikara, initially, Savur, the Chachamim thought, we're not going to disqualify a Chamson because Demei Kayoiv. Demei means the money and the value of the object. Kayoiv, he actually hands over. So again, even though the seller is not excited about the sale, he was coerced into the sale, but nevertheless, the buyer paid him for it, and therefore that's not considered gezel. But Kevan de Chazu, once in a later historical period, the Rabbanan became aware of the fact de kachatfi, that it became a little bit more common, and again, I wouldn't say it was every day of the year, but they saw that there were chotfim that would grab an object out of the hands of their rightful owner, and they would throw the money in their face. And this became like a rampant problem in Jewish society, that people were chamsonim. Just like we found before, that it became quite rampant that people would steal from a cheresh shel to a katan, so too it became common that if they were so eager to acquire ownership over an object, they would simply grab onto it and throw the money into the face of the owner. Therefore, Gazru Hu Rabbanan, in order to give teeth and make sure that this wouldn't become a Makas Medina, you know, a plague and a common practice, they said, we're going to declare any Chamson who takes the object against the will of its owner and throws the money, we're going to declare that he is Posel Li'edus. Now, here we have a Kasha of Tosfos, Divrei Maskil Meikara. That's the second Tosfos. He says, I don't understand. Even if a person, after he grabs the object, throws the money on the table, he still might be in violation of Lo Sigzol. Why? Because he first initially grabbed the object. So Tosfos rejects this, and he says, well, he grabbed the object for the purpose and with the intention of paying for it, so that's not Lo Sigzo. Then Tosfos says, but he violates another law, and that's called Lo Sachmot. Lo Sachmot means that if you desire someone else's possession to such an extent that you coerce him to give you that, to part with that possession, you violate the Isur of Lo Sachmot. Why isn't he possible? Because of Lo Sachmot. Now, Tosis is assuming that any violation in the Torah makes you into a Rasha. We mentioned earlier in the Rambam Shita that it's only a violation which generates Malkos. So now the question is, would you get Malkos for Lo Sachmot? What would have been your, if I threw this out as a quiz question, what would be your knee-jerk response? Would there be Malkos for violating Lo Sachmot, thou shalt not covet?
No.
No, for sure not. Why?
No Maisa.
There's no Maisa. It's all in the heart. But the answer is that that's not true. Because you don't violate Lo Sachmot just simply because you desire someone else's possession. That's a different law. That's called Lo Sisavah. But Lo Sachmot is only violated when you do an action and you buy the object and you do a Maisa Kinyan on the object. You'll get Malkos for the Maisa Kinyan. Tosis comes up with another answer. And he says that there's no violation of Lo Sachmot unless he doesn't pay the money. Once he pays the money, he no longer violates Lo Sachmot. This is a gigantic controversy about how do you violate Lo Sachmot. According to most Rishonim, if you desire possession of somebody else's object to such an extent that you'll coerce him to sell it and you pay him for it, you violate Lo Sachmot. But Tosis, in this first answer, you'll soon see that he has another answer. He maintains that Lo Sachmot would only be violated together with Lo Sigzol if you take the object without paying for it. Which is a Pella, because according to this Tosis, why did the Torah have to give me both Lo Sigzol and Lo Sachmot if you only violate Lo Sachmot in a case where you didn't pay for it? If you didn't pay for it, then you violated Lo Sigzol. And if you paid for it, then you don't violate Lo Sachmot, according to Tosfos. So the only violation of Lo Sachmot is when you paid for it. I'm sorry, when you didn't pay for it. And in that case, you violate Lo Sigzol. That's a Pella on this Tosfos. So let's go on to Tosfos' second answer. Tosfos' second answer says that this case of Lo Sachmot is a unique case. Why? Because what the buyer, the one who's coercing his friend to sell it, what he does is he uses a different method of coercion. It's not that he bludgeons him with a gun to his head, but rather he makes him an offer he can't refuse. You remember that phrase from the mafiosos, right? Godfather? I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. And he's mafayes the Baal. He seduces him to agree to sell. In and of itself, the Baalim have no interest in selling. I don't know if you ever had this experience where you're driving, you park your car or something, and somebody runs over to you and say, is it for sale? And the first thing you say is no. This happens a lot with apartments, with flats. You know, somebody comes over and says, you know, I see you have a beautiful apartment here. Are you selling it? And this is how agents actually go around, and they sometimes make you an offer that you can't refuse. You know, they'll pay you, you know, what you think is way above the going price. And that's a different kind of a situation. That would be Lo Sisavah, but that would not be a violation of Lo Sachmot. And the Chachamim here are addressing this particular case of a Chamson, where at the end of the day, after offering a tremendous amount of money or whatever methods of seduction to the seller, they finally got the seller to be mispayes, which means to agree begrudgingly to sell the object. In such a case, says Tosfos, there's no violation of Lo Sachmot, not because you paid for it. Even if you paid for it and threw the money down on the table, you would still be in violation of Lo Sachmot. But here you have a fayis the bailim, and at the end of the day they agreed to sell it. Now this Tosfos HaRosh, let's just see what time it is, okay, just fit in one or two more points here. The Tosfos HaRosh says that we're not talking about a case where the bailim agreed to sell it, and they said the magic words, Rotzani. That would not be considered a chamson. but perhaps they give over the object because of various pressures, but they never indicate rotsani. Now let me just give a little bit of introduction to the next Gemara, and this is the next brisa that we want to study. Again, the Chachamim are expanding the categories of psulei edus. The Odo Sifaleim, now they're going to add Roim, which means shepherds, and Gaboim and Mochsin. Gaboim were people who were appointed by the kingship to collect taxes. You know, there are taxes of many different sorts, not only today, but back in the day as well. There were taxes on real estate, which is called arnona. There was taxes even on animals per head. And you always have to pay the king a certain percentage. And if a Jew takes a position, a paid position as a gabbai on behalf of the melech, to collect taxes for the king, then for some reason, we have to see tomorrow, Mirtz Hashem, he is disqualified from testimony. And finally, the muhsin, that's a complicated issue about what muhsin is. So we'll just say it superficially, and then Belinetta will take it up tomorrow. These are people who stand on the crossroads of the highways, and they will tax each person who passes by, supposedly on behalf of the king. The question is whether they pocket some of the money for themselves for using the highway. I remember during my stay in Canada, I was in Canada for 2 years, we took a trip with the family to the Canadian Rockies. And at some point, nobody tipped us off beforehand, we found ourselves on a long line of cars, and they wouldn't let us get in to the park without paying, I think it was then, $60. Maybe it's more since then. And I said to my wife, is there any way we could see the park without going through this highway? And she turns around, she sees like 35 cars behind us. She says, you better pay the $60. You know? Anyway, there's something called muhsin, and they were in charge of collecting money in order to use the highways. And we'll see exactly tomorrow why they are postulated. So I'll take this opportunity to wish everyone a great day. And